Looking at Jacob's final months or couple years in Paddan Aram, we've been following him through his 20-year sojourn up there when he left the land of the promised land, the land of Israel. He's gone up there to flee from his brother Esau because he is outsmarted, out connived, been deceitful in getting the blessing and getting the inheritance, and now he is been sent away by his mom, Rebecca, that he'll never see again. And he's gone up here, and he's spending now time away from his family. He entered the land, if you remember, he entered the land of Paddan Aram with absolutely nothing. He's fleeing. He has nothing. He sleeps in Bethel, puts his head on a rock. He shows up with nothing and moves in with Laban. During this time now, we've studied the last 14 or 20 years, depending on how you break this down. He's gotten four wives. He's had 11 sons, one daughter. And he's been watching sheep. He's a shepherd. He works hard. He is working very, very hard every day. He's spending days out away from the home with the sheep. His sons are going to be raised as shepherds. But God has given him a promise. He is in the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God has given him a promise that he will bring him back. He will give him many descendants. And he will bless him. He gives him, it overlaps back and forth as we go through this. He uses the phrase, "I will be with you." And understand this. I'm going to talk about this a little bit today because, one, it's in the text. And, two, it may be something that we need to be reminded of or told or something. But when, now are you with me for this? Hang on. Now get ready. I'm about ready to go into an area where people may go like, well, I don't know if we should talk about that. Oh, now I've got you listening. There you go. Yeah. Oh, something we shouldn't talk about. But when it says, God says, I will be with you, in the eyes of the Jewish people, in the eyes of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as we've seen what results when God says, I will be with you. And definitely according to theology coming out of the book of Deuteronomy, when it says, I will be with you, that is the same thing as saying, you will be prosperous and successful. Did you hear what I just said? Now listen, there's a group in Christians today, the Word of Faith movement, the Get Rich Quick, the whole corrupt prosperity movement. Indeed, that is what it is. It is corrupt. It is cultish. But that doesn't mean the concept that God is in the business of prospering people is not true. Do you understand? We've got cults also that deal with end time, the end time cults. You know what the end time cults are? Jehovah Witness, Mormons, that's far enough. Okay. But they all are based coming out of the 1800s when they twisted theology and they got into eschatology and went off the deep end with it. Talking about Jesus returning, his kingdom, what it's going to be like, who gets to go to heaven. They corrupted eschatology. But that doesn't mean there isn't correct eschatology, which I think, you know, I teach. But, you know, who'll know? Study it on your own. But there is truth in eschatology. It's just that some people have taken it in the deep end. And throughout the Bible, when it says, God says, I will be with you, the result was not disease and plague and poverty and death and destruction. Hallelujah, the Lord has blessed us. When it says, I will be with you, that meant life. That meant joy. That meant prosperity. That meant success. Jesus says, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. But of course, that means we'll suffer and be in poverty forever. It's like, absolutely not. Now, understand, there is a line, and I hope you understand that I'm balanced in this, that God takes you through growth. But my point right here is, I want to talk about this just real quickly. I asked Tony for a quarter here before I came up here. And I had made sure she helped me read it. Yeah, I can see it better up here in the light. This is the United States of America quarter dollar. It says right here, and you know what I'm going to read. It says right here, in God we trust. In other words, when we founded our country or when we began to mint coins in America, we realized that our prosperity, our money, our success was tied directly in to God. God is the source of life. God is the source of all good things. And if we are going to have an economic system, if we're going to have a money system, if we're going to have a nation that is built on prosperity or has prosperity built into it, it's going to come from God. And in our story here today, we're going to see it is not Laban who is blessing Jacob. Laban is trying to deceive and steal from Jacob. It is God who says, I will be with you. And Jacob has to just continue to do what God has called him to. He's got to stay on his feet. He's got to live the way God wants to live. And God is going to, in this chapter, if I hurry up and get to it, we are going to see Jacob in a matter of a few months. He's been in Paddan Aram with Laban for 14 years. He's gotten four wives. He's gotten 12 children. Benjamin's not born. 11 sons, one daughter. And he's working very hard. Laban, we're going to find out, as we've said before, changes Jacob's wages 10 different times in an attempt to keep him down. But God continues to bless him wherever he goes, because in God we trust. We don't trust in money. We trust in God. But we know that money and prosperity and success come from God. Jacob knows that same thing. He's going to come to Laban now. It's after 14 years, probably pushing more like 15, 16, 17 years that he's been there. He's got a few years or a few months left to be there, but he is still a shepherd with no possessions. He is a shepherd working for Laban. And he's going to come and say, hey, I'm going to leave. I'm taking my family and we're leaving. And Laban's going to say, hey, wait. Why don't I go ahead and let you keep some of the sheep? And that is all that Jacob the deceiver, or the ingenious, depends on how you want to look at this. You can make a decision when we go through this. Jacob, that's all Jacob needs is an opportunity, and all God needs to bless Jacob. He is now going to get paid in flocks, in sheep. And in the process of time, in a matter of one chapter, the majority of Laban's flocks are going to be transferred to Jacob, so that we're going to see, just like we saw Abraham, we talked about Abraham, he went to Egypt, he came back to Canaan. Abraham had many, many men servants and maid servants and cattle and flocks and sheep. Abraham was blessed beyond imagination. The same verse is found with Isaac. Many men servants and maid servants. The Lord has been with him, the Lord has blessed him, and he's got all of this. Jacob so far, no. Jacob himself is going to describe his life as difficult and short. He's running, he's fleeing, he's living in a foreign country, came in with nothing. But in this chapter, he is going to catch up with Abraham and Isaac, and the verse is going to be said. He has accumulated many men servants, maid servants, he's got flocks, he's got children, he's got wife. He is very prosperous. And realize, how did that happen? It happened because God said, I will be with you. Now, I want to just do something fun here, possibly. And again, I do not want to be blasphemous. I do not want to go off the deep end on this and become people say, well, that's just that prosperity. No, I think it's time that Americans, including us, realize that money, prosperity, comes from God. It is not something that, well, we go to church on Sundays and then, okay, the rest we got to go and try and figure out how we're going to make money, make a living. Hey, I got an idea. Let's have the government print more money, give us all bailout. There you go. In the government we trust, print more money. That's enough of that. But it's like if we would trust in God. I mean, we print it on our coins, and you know there's a movement to try and get that off our coin. Because what do we want? And more than anything else in America, we want more poverty. Let's get God off our coins. Let's trust in the government. In the government we trust, print more money, because we are heading into death, destruction, and poverty. Don't trust God. I'm telling you right now, we need to trust God. We need to realize, understand, the reason sometimes people don't go to God and say, God, I need resources. I need money. I need help financially. The reason they don't go to God and ask that kind of a question is because they've been told God isn't interested in money. Listen, my friends, that comes from this right here. That comes from scriptural ignorance. If you read the Bible, there are hundreds of verses about the eschatology of Jesus coming back and the ends of time. And of process time. But there are also hundreds of verses about finances, about God working in people's lives. Well, yes, but Pastor, remember Jesus was poor. Yeah, I remember hearing that. Jesus was poor. How many have heard Jesus was poor? He slept in the dirt. Remember that time? He says, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. So we were to assume that when Jesus got tired, he just crawled down there on the dirt and said, hey guys, I'm going to doze off here for a little bit, and slept in the dirt. He had no bed. He had no house. Man, the guy's poor. He was the Christ. Are you still with me on this? Are you okay with this? I guess the point of this, what I'm saying, is we're going to go through this story. But I want you to realize that in times of economic crisis, in times when our government is trying to figure out, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We're going to give away money. God has already addressed this. God has says, I will be with you. He says, I will take care of you. And that doesn't just mean sometime in eternity. That means now. Well, I want to show you a few verses, if you don't mind. Please go to the Gospels. Are you all right with this? I don't know. Go to Luke. Luke chapter 2. We're just going to fly through some verses. I'm going to present something to you that to give you possibly. And again, we want truth. We don't want a cult. We don't want some kind of fake prosperity message. But I just like I told you weeks ago, this one youth group pastor, he said, we don't have time to teach the Bible to our kids, but they love Jesus. Listen, if you don't know the Word of God, if you haven't met Jesus, if you don't know the details, you may love something called Jesus, but you don't know Jesus. You can't love the truth. And here we go in Luke. I want to show you, I'm going to read you Bible verse. I'm going to give you a slight interpretation of them. You've got to be the one who decides, am I twisting Scripture? Or am I just showing you something that you've never seen because of your religious mind and because of, I don't want to say carnality, but because of the secular world has separated the God of life from your financial situation. Here we go. This is not our message today. This is just our introduction. Luke chapter 2. First of all, Luke chapter 2, verse 24, when Jesus was born, his mother and father, and some of this we've talked about in different times before, we'll just breeze through it, that his mother, after 40 days, had to go present an offering at the temple. They were supposed to, after 40 days after a boy was born, the mother had to present a purification offering in the temple. They're supposed to bring a sheep, a lamb, 80 days for a girl. Now, I haven't really figured out why it was 40 days for a boy and 80 days for a girl, except girls are, you know, worse or something. I don't know. But it's in the law. But nonetheless, verse 24, and it says, they went there to Jerusalem and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, the law of Moses, a pair of doves or two young pigeons. Oh, by the way, what they're saying right there is when you go back and you read that in the law, it says they're supposed to bring a lamb. But if they are too poor to have a lamb, we'll take two cheap birds. That's good enough. We want everybody from all social standing to be able to come and meet the Lord at the temple. And if you don't have any money, if you're dirt poor, and you can only spend a couple of pennies and get a couple of birds, a couple of doves, or a couple of young pigeons, well, that's fine. Bring in the birds. What did Mary and Joseph bring? They were dirt poor. They had left Nazareth. They were down there out of sync with society. They had a flea. I mean, she got pregnant. The whole story. And these guys are running. Their families rejected them. And so down here, they've got a bird, bring some cheap birds. Poor. They are poor. Okay? That's what that verse would say. Okay. Very good. We've established that fact. Go to Matthew chapter 2. Sometime after those first 40 days, and you know this too if you've been paying attention, sometime before Jesus was 2 years old, but after the first 40 days, these guys show up from the east. You've heard this story possibly. The wise men. And traditionally there's three wise men. But I'm going to read now in Matthew 2, verse 11. On coming to the house, the wise men came to Mary and Mary's house. And Joseph isn't in this little verse here because, I don't know, I think Joseph is working. I think Joseph's out making a living. But in the house there sometime with a little boy is Mary. And the wise men, this is verse 11, the wise men on coming to the house, they, the wise men, saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures. Also could be translated coffers or treasure boxes. This wasn't something they picked up at Walmart on the way over. This wasn't something they picked up at, you know, Target. Those are not camp or commercials. It's something they just picked up. Here's a little gift. I just want to let you know. This is something that they brought from the east, and they brought treasure boxes. They opened up their treasures or their treasure boxes and presented him with gifts, plural, of gold and of incense and of myrrh. Now, you can read that. Just study it. Think about what you want there. But traditionally, you got three guys showing up. They've each got high. We worship the baby. They kneel down, take a little photograph for the nativity scene. And then they all, oh, little bop, bop, there's my gold. Bop, there's my myrrh. Bop, there's my incense. We'll be going now. Herod wants to kill the baby and us, so we got to leave. And she had these three little things that she put on her shelf and decorated around her fireplace with, and they dusted them every Christmas, and it was a nice little, that's the gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Go with that if you'd like to. Or possibly, in a more of a historical, realistic setting, these were not just three guys wandering around with camels. This was a caravan of wise men that showed up. The three guys wouldn't just wander around with three camels. They would have traveled in a pack. And when it says coffers or treasures or treasure boxes, that means they brought in their servants. These guys didn't bring them off their camels. Their servants would have brought in a trunk or several trunks. And in those trunks was treasures that included gold treasures and frankincense and myrrh, more than just a little bop, bop, bop. I don't want to stretch the story. But from this point on, they're not poor, depending on what you want to do with the gifts. If they're just going to set them on the fireplace, they're still poor. But if they're treasure boxes, that would mean they would have enough resources to, one, flee the country, live in Egypt for 2 years in a foreign country, come back up to Nazareth in a couple years, start a carpentry business, and then execute or live a life of a business training Jesus to also be a carpenter and take care of the family to manage what God had provided for them. I think it was a little more of an investment into the future Son of God, or the Son of God's future, or his college fund, if you would. Now, let's go to another verse, if you don't mind. Let's go to John chapter 1. This could be three verses here. John chapter 1. Chapter 2. John chapter 2. Okay, so here's our story. We're still, here's Jesus, the poor Son of God, who's going to sleep in the dirt. He just got loaded up with treasures, okay, as an infant. His father's now a professional carpenter. He himself is a professional carpenter. The book of Proverbs says, all work brings a profit. So we got to assume that they're making some kind of money, and Jesus is working. We do figure, as the story goes in Jesus' life, that Joseph dies. We're going to lose him eventually. He never shows up after 30 years. We never hear of Joseph, which it gives us impression here. Jesus was the oldest son. If he's following the traditions of the culture, when the father dies, guess who's in charge of the family then? The oldest son, especially if he's teenage, 20, 25 years old, he's now taking care of the family, including he's in charge of his mother, he's in charge of making sure of his brothers all get an education, they're all raised, whatever needs to be taken, Jesus is taking care of that. But Jesus does something strange at the age 30. At age 30, Jesus goes into the ministry, which involves going to the wilderness for 40 days, getting baptized by John, and then choosing 12 disciples to follow him. Now, you've got to ask a couple questions here. Is Jesus putting the call of God above his family responsibilities? I would say no, because that's going to get in trouble with Paul, you know, who's going to write, if a man doesn't take care of his family, he's worse than an unbeliever. Jesus somehow has to maintain some kind of care of his family. He's going to enter this ministry. He's no longer going to be a carpenter. He's not going to take time off. I've got to go to work on Monday. Yeah. I know some people that do that. He's going to then go into the ministry, spend 40 days in the wilderness, come back and choose 12 men and says, follow me. They lay down their nets, they begin to follow him. Somewhere there's got to be some financial backing in this whole thing because he lives in a real world. You got the verse, we can go look at the verse if you want to. I got them written down here. In Matthew 15 and Luke 8, it says, some women from Galilee were providing for him from their own means, both in food and in care. It says that. But I don't think that's the entire story. Jesus at age 30 apparently had some kind of resources that he could, in a sense, retire, enter the ministry, and take care of his mother. Here's a verse right here, John chapter 2, verse 12. I'm going to present to you now, again, this is not like saying Jesus took care of his mother, but that Jesus, even after he began the ministry, had to have some kind of financial responsibility for his mother and his brothers until they were old enough to take care of themselves. Watch this in chapter 2 of John, verse 12. After this, he went down to Capernaum, and his mother and brothers and his disciples, or with his mother, brothers, and disciples, there they stayed for a few days. Now, we could also lead, I've got verses here that we could look at. It appears he also had a house there in Capernaum, some kind of a house for his family. Some people think he lived in Peter's house, kind of awkward. Moved in with Peter, with Peter's mother-in-law, brought his mother, brought all of his brothers, they were all coming over. or Jesus at his own house in Capernaum? That's the question. But I will tell you this. What was one of the things Jesus said on the cross? He said seven things on the cross. Any of them would be fine. But there's one I'm particularly interested in. It deals with his mother. What did Jesus say on the cross about his mother? Indicating to me something very important. He looked at John and said, "Behold your mother, mother, behold your son." That was a legal transaction. Because the son, the eldest son, was now dying. Just like it says in the law of Moses, a man is married to his wife until they die. Upon death, the woman is free to marry somebody or the man is free to marry somebody else. The contract is now null and void. The responsibility has been fulfilled. Jesus has been taking care of his mother, I believe, since the time his father died up until he's on the cross. Why else would he look at John and say, "Behold your mother, mother, behold your son"? And then it says, and she went and lived in John's house after that. And John's house apparently had a house in Jerusalem along with a place up in Galilee. John himself wasn't poor. So he was taking care of his mother this entire time. Something was taking place there. Another thing I'd like to mention here as we go through this. Go to John chapter 12, since we're there. John chapter 12. John chapter 12, verse 6. Because if Jesus, the reason I'm sharing this, because if Jesus, this is always the cop-out, if Jesus, the Son of God, just lived in the streets and slept in the dirt, then that's about all we can expect. We've got to then figure out some other way to make money. We've got to figure out some other way to get blessed, because God's not going to take care of us. Now, I know in my world, I have responsibility, I have financial commitments. I've got to take care of my kids. And it sure is a lot easier for me when times are tough to be able to say, "Dear God, help me pay my bills. Dear God, in you we trust. I need money." Okay. Christian can't pray that. Jesus never prayed that. He didn't say, "Ask God for money." Well, I mean, I can show you places in there, but I can tell you what I'm telling you right now is Jesus was financially well taken care of. I'm not saying he is a prosperity minister flying around in some jet taking huge offerings. In fact, that's another thing. Did Jesus take offerings? Remember the time they multiplied the bread? On your way out, I'd like to have you all make a little donation for the bread fund. Or when he healed the leper, yes, thank God, but go ahead and meet my treasure, make a little donation to the offering so that others can be healed around the world. I don't remember Jesus ever even bringing money up as far as, "Boy, our ministry is really suffering this year. We'd like to have you all take a little collection. I'm training these disciples. They don't have jobs. They're committed full time to the Lord. If you could all make a small donation so we could take care of the..." I never remember ever seeing Jesus take an offering. Never. Not saying he didn't. I'm just saying him collecting money wasn't an issue. He was interested in ministering and somebody was providing for him. Well, look at this. We're in John chapter 12. How much money did Jesus have? John chapter 12, verse 6. This is the story about him being anointed in Bethany. A woman comes up, anoints him, and all the disciples freak out. Judas mainly, but they all freak out because they took a woman takes what would take a year of money to pay for, say if you make $20,000 a year or $50,000 a year, whatever. That was what this perfume cost. And she went up and she broke it and poured it on Jesus' feet. It'd be like burning up $20,000 or $50,000. Or if you're a shop teacher, $150,000 annual salary, whatever. Okay, at least you're listening. And she dumped this on his feet. And this was like, now listen, a good religious person say, whoa, this is unnecessary. All of that, and who are the religious people in the crowd? The disciples. We should take this and sell this. This could have been sold. This is funny stuff. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm laughing ahead of you. These religious people, they go, oh, we just lost $20,000. We just dumped $50,000 on the ground. We would like to have had that money. Better not say that. What should we say? We could have given that to the poor. Are these guys interested in the poor? Maybe. But I'm going to show you in a minute who was interested in the poor. It wasn't the disciples. It was Jesus was interested in the poor. The disciples just said that because that's acceptable. Oh, what about the poor? And Jesus said something very irreligious. He says, "You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." He said, "That was a good thing to do. You're always going to have poor people to take care of. If you want to take care of poor people, there's some out there right now. But I'm leaving." But look in verse 6. I'll be beginning in verse 5. Judas Iscariot objected, says, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor?" Now, we're going to make a connection here for you in just a minute. And the money given to the poor. It was worth a year's wage. Now, John says, John, who knew Judas, wrote this. He says, he did not say this because he cared about the poor. And listen, I'll just tell you that too. A lot of times when people say, we care about the poor, they don't care about the poor. They're just using the poor as a target for you to give money to them so they can take care of the poor. But really, we want you to give us the money. Now, just keep. There's been warnings about that in the paper, by the way, too. Nonprofit companies taking money. Something like 12% of the money you give to a nonprofit organization actually goes to the poor. Well, Judas was in that position. You're going to find out in just a minute who was in charge of the money bag. Judas was in charge of the treasury. Jesus had a money bag. You got a money bag? My wife's got a purse. That's where I got the quarter from this morning. But I don't have a money bag. I got a checking account. I try and keep above zero. But I don't have a money bag. Jesus had a money bag. And the person in charge of the money bag was Judas. Look at this. Verse 6. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, Judas, but because he was a thief. So if you're always, here's just a little warning. If you're always around, well, we care about the poor, we care about the poor. Yeah, Judas did too. He was a thief. Are you a thief? As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. He says, well, we should have given this, we should have sold this. Put it in the money bag so I could give it to the poor. Now, did you make the connection right there? Where's Judas want the money? In the money bag. Because then I can help distribute the money to the poor. But John says he didn't care. He wanted the money in the money bag. Because he's a thief. He wants the money. Okay, let's go back to my checking account. I trust my wife. She handles my finances. Really, she does. That's the only reason we still are on top. Is because she says, no, no, you can't buy that. No, you can't do that. Okay? Thank God for a wife that can handle the money. But if she was a thief, and she was stealing money, or if I had a ministry, and somebody was stealing money out of my ministry, substantial amount of money, do you think I would notice? Yeah, I would notice when the checks started bouncing and the bank started calling. Jesus had someone taking care of his money bag who was stealing from it. Embezzlement was taking place. For embezzlement to happen, there has to be a substantial amount of money for that money to be removed and yet still have a balance that gives an appearance that everything's fine. So this was not just an empty money bag that Jesus was carrying around or Judas had. This is a money bag that had substantial amount of money that Judas was stealing from, and yet nobody knew. They never bounced a check. But yet Judas, who was in charge of the finances, was stealing. Did you know that? Okay. Let's go on. So let's go to John 13. This is another good verse. John 13, 29. Yeah. I don't know, if you just compare your financial situation now to Jesus' financial situation, I don't know your financial situation, but if you compared mine to Jesus, Jesus is a lot more financially solid than I am. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying Jesus is not some poor guy sleeping in the dirt. Watch this. They're at the Last Supper now. Judas, he just told Judas to go ahead and betray him. He says, what you're about to do it quickly. Jesus told him in verse 28, but no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Jesus just tells Judas, go do what you're going to do. Do it quickly. Get out of here. Go do it. And they don't know what he's talking about. So they now got to assume Judas is going to stand up from this very important meal and leave. He's going to exit the holiday meal. He's leaving. He's walking out of the meal. And the disciples look, it's like, where's he going? Well, I think he's going to go betray the Lord. I think he's going to go talk to the high priest. You know he's a thief. They know none of that. But all they know is that Jesus sent him on a mission. So here they've got to assume. Here's what they assume. Now watch. I don't want to be rude here. But if anybody in the audience right now stands up and walks out, one, I think, well, they didn't like the message so far. Or two, you've got to go to the bathroom. I mean, if you stand up and walk out, no one's going to leave now. But it's like if someone stands up and they begin to exit and I happen to see you, I'm thinking, well, I hope I didn't say something offensive. That's my first thought. And the other one is like, well, they're probably just going to the bathroom. I continue. Because that is generally what happens. Usually I offend people or they go to the bathroom. It's not that exciting here. But when Judas leaves the meal, they make an assumption. As soon as Jesus, let's see, where am I at? Yeah, there it is.
Some thought, I'm in verse 29, since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the feast. Now you get a picture of who's paying for all this food for this feast. Jesus' money bag. He got the upper room all set up. He goes, we need a place to stay. Told the disciples, go get what we need. They take some money from Judas. They go and they start buying stuff. They get the meal prepared. Jesus is funding the Last Supper. Did you know that? Jesus' money bag is paying for the Last Supper. How could that be? I thought he was poor. Yeah, right. What was needed for the feast, or the other thing, he's either going to go buy what was needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. Now, I don't want to be rude, but if one of you stood up and walked out the door, I'm thinking I just ticked you off. I'm not thinking, well, you know, they probably thought, I just remembered a poor person that needs some money. I'm going to take care of that right now. I don't think I've ever had somebody stand up in a church service and walk out because I got to go give money to the poor. Now, for me to think that would mean that would have to happen frequently. If you stand up and walk out, now he just left. He's taking a kid out. He's not going to the bathroom. I can tell. That happens frequently. I don't think he's going to go give money to the poor because I think he's going to go, well, don't turn around, but I can tell. You understand what I'm saying? For Judas to leave a meal and the disciples think, oh, he's giving money to the poor, would mean that was a constant practice of Jesus. When he called Judas, he either needs, we need to buy money for the meal, or we need to go give money to the poor. And Judas was constantly giving money away, probably driving him crazy. Although he said, well, we care about the poor. We care about the poor. It's like he's taking some for himself because he's poor too, probably, he thinks. Do you understand that? Did you know that verse was in there? Jesus, in his ministry, was not just healing the sick or teaching. Jesus was giving money to the poor out of his money bag, taking care of his mother until he died on the cross, having disciples, not having a full-time job. Jesus had some kind of financial backing. And one last one. If we go to, I don't know if I can find the verse, but you know that verse right there about on the cross when they're tearing his garments. Remember that? Yeah, there it is. Chapter 19, verse 24. The soldiers are dividing Jesus' garments. Took all of his garments. They've stripped him down. They're plundering what's left of him. Judas, of course, still has the money bag, or someone's got the money bag. And they put the clothes in four piles or something. Everybody's getting a little piece of these clothes. But they came to his robe. Look at this. Verse 23. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them. So he had enough clothes that he could divide it into four piles of clothes just on his body. And they wanted them. You know, someone's going to crucify me. I don't think they're going to pile my clothes up and say, I'll take the shirt, you can have the pants, man, I want those shoes. I don't think that's going to happen. With the undergarment remaining, this garment now, we stop and talk about one piece of Jesus' clothing. They've already divided up the clothes, but stop, there's one more left. Who's going to get this? Well, we could tear it. It's like, we're not tearing this. This garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. In other words, this was quality. This was some nice clothes. Let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot who gets it. Now my question, being a good religious person and caring about the poor, is why would Jesus, if he was the Messiah, have a piece of clothing that valuable and not have sold it and given the money to the poor? If he really was God and really loved the poor, he would be wearing some cheap stuff. I'm being facetious right there. I'm just saying, how does that line up? Jesus had money, he had clothes, and the last thing right here, just to mention this, if Jesus is walking in obedience to the Abrahamic covenant, which he was, walking blamelessly in the law of Moses, every law, everything handed down by God in those first five books says, you walk blameless before me, I will be with you, I'll open the heavens to you. Listen, for Jesus to be poor and not have provisions would be a violation of the covenant of Abraham. Did you understand what I just said? Jesus, if we don't read any of those verses, Jesus had to have some kind of financial backing. Because one, money comes from God. God has taken care of him. And God is under a contract, under a covenant obligation to watch over the sons of Israel that are walking in his ways and provide for him. And we just read several verses that indicate Jesus wasn't poor. Jesus wasn't begging for money. Jesus wasn't just eating at people's house because I have no place to go my own place. I'll just eat at your place. Jesus was even to the end, the Last Supper, the last hours of his ministry, still had enough money in the money bag for Judas to be giving money to the poor and buying meals. Now, that is not a prosperity message. That is not telling you you should all buy big cars and have ridiculous money and have golden toilets in your house. That is not the message. The message is, in God we trust. And Jesus himself in his personal life, like everything, is an example of someone who went through his life trusting God, and God provided for him. I challenge you, if you have financial needs, if in this time of economic crisis and your name is not on the bailout list, so what? In God we trust. The money you spend says that anyhow. It's reminding you, God is the provider. God is with you. God will take care of you. I'm not telling you God is going to meet all of your needs to the sense that you get whatever you can imagine, but I am telling you this. There are principles in the Bible. You'll follow those principles. We could spend weeks talking about this. But let's go to Genesis chapter 30. Chapter 30. Here we go. Well, that was interesting. The reason I wanted to share that with you was before we read this and you completely disassociate yourself from this chapter, say, well, that was the grandson of Abraham, that was the law of Moses, that was a Jew. That this is God dealing with the person that he has chosen, dealing with the person he has called. He says, I will be with you. How many times does the New Testament say God is with you? Now, Hebrews, listen, I'm going to go to Hebrews, read a verse just so I can balance this all out. Hebrews chapter 13. Okay, I'm going to read. If you want to go there, you can, but I'm going to write back to Jen. I just want to balance this out. Chapter 13, verse 5. Are you ready? Hebrews 13, verse 5. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Now, in light of what we've talked about, that is saying your job is not to pursue money. Your job is not to say, I want more, I want more, I want more, but be content with what you have, realizing that God says, I will never leave you. But that's what he told Jacob too. I will be with you, which means what? To be with you means I will take care of you, I will prosper you, I will make sure you have what you need. We're not here to pursue material things, but we do need material things. I just get upset when we separate our relationship with God from our finances. It's like, well, we trust God and he wants us poor, wants us this, wants us that. It's like, meanwhile, in my real world, I've got to figure out how to get some money. I'm telling you, connect them. The same God who says, I will never leave you, I have paid for your sins, I'm going to be with you, means in every area, including your finances. And Jesus was a classic example of someone who was taken care of by God. Let's go to Genesis chapter 30. Chapter 30, verse 25. After Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, send me on my way so I can go back to my homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I have done for you. Now, this could be last week. I gave the impression that the children were born from the 8th year up until the 20th year, and that could be. This gives us more of a light that this maybe is reduced even down to those 7 years. Now he's going to work 7 years for Leah, 7 years for Rachel, and now he's got 6 more years left. In that second 7 years, he's had all these children. I don't necessarily know if that's the case, but somewhere in this, again, time frame, we don't know exactly what's taking place, but we do have to have enough time for these Nixie verses to take place in that 20 years. He says, I've served, and at this point, if it be 14 years or 16 years or 18 years he's been there, he said, I've got my children, I've got my wives, give them to me, imperative, I want my family, and I'm leaving. And he's going to leave at that point with nothing but what he had with his wives and his family. He's not going to have any possession, he's got his wages, he's heading back. But Laban said to him, remember, these are two guys that are trying to outsmart each other, they've been going back and forth at each other for this whole time, 14, 18 years. But Laban said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. So some kind of spiritual connection. Again, divination gives an impression of witchcraft, of something negative. Whatever is being said here is Laban has learned that the reason, because Laban has, when Jacob came, Laban had very little. He had some daughters that he could sell for 7 years of labor. And with that labor, he was hoping to kind of get a little bit further ahead in life. But because he's had Jacob work for him for 14 years, Jacob has taken the little bit that Laban's had and multiplied it. So Laban himself now has increased in wealth. And that is, again, as part of the Abrahamic covenant. Those who bless you, the Lord will bless them. And in this case, another example of someone living outside the land of Israel being blessed because of Abraham, Isaac, or in this case, Jacob. He says, I've learned that the reason I'm so successful is because you are here. That's, again, another important thing for you to understand as a Christian, is wherever you work, they should be blessed because of your presence. They should prosper because you're in the building. They should prosper because you're on the job. You should be benefited. God is blessing you. We just said that. God says, I'll be with you. If God is with you, he should be able to manifest himself through you, and those around you themselves will be blessed. And Laban says, the reason I even have a half a chance is you're here, Jacob. Now he says, listen, name your wages and I will pay them. In other words, so far he hasn't really been getting paid except probably food and lodging and a couple wives. Okay, he says, that deal's over. Let me give you a deal. What do you want? Some wages, a contract. What do you want? Jacob said to him, you know how I have worked for you and how your livestock has fared under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. In God we trust. That's why our money says, in God we trust, because you can't do anything without God. And the reason Laban has prospered is because God has blessed him. The reason America prospers is God has blessed America, which then reversed that process is why the bailout? Why the economic trouble? Maybe we need to get back to trusting God. But no, that's another subject. Or sermon, at least. Not a different subject. But now, when may I do something for my own household? He said, I blessed your house. When can I start building my own estate? So I'm leaving. Well, verse 31, what shall I give you, he asked. Laban says, what do you want? Don't give me anything, Jacob replied. I don't want anything. Similar to the way Abraham talked to Sodom and Gomorrah, the king of Sodom. I don't want anything. But, he says, if you'll do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Again, that doesn't mean just watching the sheep. That means taking care of them, making sure they're healthy, make sure they're productive, make sure they're increasing. That's his business. I'll continue to manage your business. Let me go through all the flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat. They will be my wages. Now, in one sense, most of the animals here would be either all white or all black, but they had some of the genetics. Again, I'm out of my league right here, okay? I'm going to start talking about animal genetics. I just gave you my expertise on financial management. Now my animal science. But genetically, that's not going to stop me, though. I'm going to press on. The white and black animals, they would continue to produce white and black animals. And Laban, the word Laban means white. And the animals right here, talking about white animals, Jacob said, I'll just take the speckled. Anyone that's not purely white or purely black, I'll take the speckled ones. Laban thinks, sure. That's a good idea. Laban realizes this is a ridiculous. You're asking for the least I could possibly produce is the speckled animals. Some like 20% they say would be speckled. And continuing from here, if he gets from the flock, and if he separates them, the white and black sheep are going to end up being purified and stop producing those speckled animals. The problem is, again, is that the genetics is within the animals. Even the white and black ones, the genetics are in there. They may be white on the outside, but they still have the genetics. Watch this. Here we go. Okay, here we go. Don't give me anything. I'll work for you for this one thing, tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through and get all the speckled and spotted sheep. They'll be my wages, verse 33. And my honesty will testify for me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages you have paid me, any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark colored, will be considered stolen. So when you come and check my sheep, my flocks, if I've got a pure white one or, you know, it's not speckled, he says, you know I stole it from you. So I'll just take the speckled ones. Laban says, that's a good. Agreed, said Laban, verse 34. Let it be as you have said. That same day he removed all the male goats that were streaked or spotted, and all the speckled or spotted females, and they had all that had white on them, and all the dark-colored lambs. He placed them in the care of his sons. Okay, so now his sons are old enough. They're, you know, teenagers, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, the oldest ones. And they've got their own flocks. Now he sends a spot. They're sent away. And in the next verse, then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flocks. So Jacob's over here watching Laban's flocks. His sons are over here watching the few spotted and speckled sheep over here. What's about to transpire in the next few months is Jacob is going to begin to transfer this flock over to this flock. He's going to transfer from Laban's estate into Jacob's estate. And how this is going to happen is a little bit of animal science, a little bit of, well, not a little bit, but it's going to be mainly God's blessing and Jacob's ingenuity on how to do this. He's made a deal. It's a fair deal. And Laban leaves Jacob with his flock. You remember what happened with Esau and the birthright? Jacob got it. You remember with Jacob and the blessing? Jacob got it. Laban now says, okay, you just watch my flock. If any spotted or speckled ones are born, you can have them. Not a big deal. That's fine. But he's leaving Jacob alone with his flock. Jacob's not going to steal them. He's already built in a factor. If they're white or black and they're in my flock, I stole them. I'll just take the speckled ones. But now Jacob's job now is to convert these white sheep, the offspring from the white and black, and convert them into, well, speckled. Verse 37. Jacob, however, took fresh cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they made it in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. And Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked yet dark. Okay, so what he does, he takes some white wood, wood that is white, the wood on the inside is white, but has a darker bark on it. He peels back some of the bark, and when the animals come to drink, he sets it either in front or in the trough. He's like doing some kind of visualization. It's like, we're thinking, so the branches would be white with streaks on them, or dark with white streaks because they've been peeled back. So he's like, somehow, no one really understands what's taking place here. I mean, it's like, how can putting these wooden branches in front of the sheep, it's got to be visualization. We're looking for some, before you start mating, he said, here's what we're looking for. We're looking for the combination, the dark and white combination. Okay, and then they would mate, and guess what they would produce? Exactly what they'd visualize. There's the power of visualization right there for you in the Bible. I got several jokes right there that I'm stopping. I'm going to continue. Okay. Verse 40. Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. Thus he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. So what he's going to do now, basically what he's going to do now, in action makes some sense. He's going to end up separating the stronger animals, which tend to have the genetics of the speckled in them, and the other ones that were, though, just white and black, and separate them. So he's going to end up with a part of his flock that are stronger and part of the flock that is weaker. And he's going to encourage these to mate to produce the speckled, which would be the colored plus the stronger, and start sending them over to his sons. So you've got Jacob out in the field with all of your possessions, with a contract that if you can turn them into speckled and spotted, you can have them. So all day long for these next several years or months, Jacob is working this flock, and he is consumed with this so that by the end of the time he gets done, well, let's read on. Verse 41, whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. Somehow he's drawing the stronger animals together with these branches, plus the visualization. So the weak animals went to Laban, and the strong ones went to Jacob. In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. And that's the verse I was talking about. That's the verse we've been waiting for. Abraham had that verse. Isaac had that verse. Now, after 20 years, after having come to Padan Aram and only having the promise, I will be with you, having been ripped off and been in servanthood as a servant for 20 years, Jacob now accomplishes the Abrahamic covenant. He's got the same thing Abraham and Isaac had, but he got it on his own. He got it because God was with him and he kept working the system, and here he is. If anybody set up for failure, it's Jacob. But after 20 years, he's got this. First chapter 31, we're going to have to wrap this up. Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father. And Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude toward him was not what it had been. After a period of several months, a couple of years, Laban's sons, what are they doing? Where are they at? Jacob is like the family slave. He's out taking care of all the flocks. Laban's sons are back home counting the money or something. And all of a sudden they realize their monthly income is going down. I mean, it's tanking. They're calling for an economic bailout. It's like, this is disastrous. And they realize, but Jacob, look at what he's got. And they realize what Jacob has done. He's transferred Laban's inheritance, or Laban's son's inheritance, has been transferred to their brother-in-law's account. They are now, they've lost their inheritance. And of course, it says Laban's attitude changed towards Jacob. At this point, verse 3, we haven't heard this. We've just been watching Jacob live these 20 years. God spoke to him at Bethel. Jacob's now been there for 20 years doing what God's called him to do. Verse 3, then the Lord said to Jacob, God now speaks to him, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah, watch this, to come out to the fields where his flocks were. He said to them, so they're living back in the tents. He says, I sent someone in to get them. Come on, he says, okay. He says, I see that your father's attitude towards me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. There it is. See what I'm saying? The God of my father has been with me. How do you know? Well, I just have this peace. I just am happy all the time. He says, no, look around. God of my fathers is with me. Look at my flock. I have prospered. Again, there's more to a relation with God than prosperity. But right here, the sign right here, he says, look what God has done for me. It's around. You know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. And that is also in that next verse. If we go back to Hebrews chapter 13 there, he says, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. The next part is, for what can man do to me? In man's system, if God is with you, there is nothing man can do to you to offset the system that God has. God says, I'll be with you. Jacob is in a foreign country working for a man who's trying to rip him off, but he's got this one thing. God says, I'll be with you. The man's going to rip you off 10 different ways, but I'm with you. Don't worry about what man will do to you. Because be content with what you have, because I will take care of you. He says, look at this. They've ripped me off this whole time, and I've still got the entire estate. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said, the speckled ones will be your wages, then all the flocks gave birth to speckled young. And if he said, the streaked ones will be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me. And then he goes through, he talks about a vision that he had right here. I'm going to read this and be done. In breeding season, he's still talking to Leah and Rachel, his two wives, Laban's two daughters. In breeding season, I once had a dream. And this may come where you get the idea from where you got the wood idea. In which I looked up and I saw the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. The angel of God, and this would be the one who appeared to him at Bethel, which would probably most likely be a theophany or an Old Testament appearance of the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. The angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. I answered, here I am. And he said, look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land. And that's why he called his two wives out of the field. He says, I've had this dream. He says, it's time to go back. The God of Bethel that appeared to me when I left 20 years ago has now appeared and says, it's time to go back. Now watch, this is Rachel and Leah's attitude. Then Rachel and Leah replied, do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? No. Does he not regard us as foreigners like you, Jacob? Yes. Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what he was paid for us. In other words, there's no dowry left. Whatever they got from selling him for their marriage, he says, he's used it. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you. His wives don't need to be convinced that they need to leave their father. They say, yeah, he's ripped us all off. He says, but, and notice what they say, we now see that we're going to follow your God. In a sense, just like if you go with Ruth or you go with Rebecca, when they see this promise and they see the things of God, they say, we will leave our family and we will come with you. They are believers. They say, we're going to go with you and your God. We see what he's done. Our father's been ripping us off, but your God has been taking care of you. And so his daughters are ready to go. The next thing we see now is the exodus, the escape plan to get back to Paddan Aram. And what you've got now, as we wrap the story up, you've got Jacob fleeing from Laban and his sons because he just ripped them off, they think, although it's been all in the contract, fleeing back to Israel or Canaan, where guess who's waiting for him? Esau, the guy he's been fleeing from for 20 years. So it's a typical case of jumping from the frying pan into the fire or from the fire back into the frying pan or something. Jacob's caught between two places. The thing he's got going for him is the God of Bethel has appeared and says, it's time to return. And he's going to just bring him back. It's going to be an exciting adventure going back. He's going to actually get a chance to meet God. God's going to appear to him again and deal with him. Well, there's a lot of things there. I hope you enjoyed that. Hope that helps you. But remember, in God we trust. We're not crazy prosperity, but we do realize that our trust is in God and that God will be with us and God will take care of us. Father, we do thank you so much for being with us. We thank you for watching over us. We do ask that we may be responsible in our life before you, and we do ask that you'd show us how we are to take care of our finances and how we are to prosper and do the things that you've called us to. Again, we pray for our country. We ask that we may see revival, that we indeed may learn to trust you again. Father, we do thank you for all that you've done for us, and ask that this church may be a light. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.